Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a number of subjects in the news. We'll begin in a moment on this Labor Day weekend and speak with the former Secretary of Labor, Robert Reich, who served in three national administrations, most recently as the nation's 22nd Secretary of Labor under President Bill Clinton. In that capacity, he implemented the Family and Medical Leave Act, led the national fight against sweatshops in the United States and illegal child labor around the world. He headed the administration's successful efforts to raise the minimum wage, secured workers' pensions, and much more. He's written a number of books, a lot of them bestsellers, The Future of Success and Locked in the Cabinet. And his most recent book is Reason. So we'll be doing an update on the state of labor and in the country. And then we'll talk about Kofi Annan's trip. He's currently in Tehran, where apparently he has extracted an agreement from the Iranians to seriously discuss the nuclear issue, which is before the United Nations Security Council, where sanctions are hanging. We will talk with Dr. Vali Nasser, who's a professor in the Department of National Security Affairs at the Naval Postgraduate School. He's the author of a number of books, including Democracy in Iran, The Islamic Leviathan, and his most recent, The Shia Revival, How Conflicts Within Islam Will Shape the Future. A couple of weeks ago, Dr. Nasser and a small group of outside advisors met with President Bush to bring a fresh perspective on the Iranian question. So we'll be talking about that as well. And then in the final segment, we'll speak with Tom Hartman, who's a nationally syndicated radio host with Air America and a Project Censored award-winning best-selling author of 17 books. His latest book is Screwed, The Undeclared War Against the Middle Class and What We Can Do About It. Let's begin on this Labor Day with the former Secretary of Labor, Dr. Robert Reich, who served in three national administrations, most recently as the nation's 22nd Secretary of Labor under President Bill Clinton. As I mentioned, in that capacity, he implemented the Family and Medical Leave Act, led the national fight against sweatshops in the United States and illegal child labor around the world, headed the administration's successful effort to raise the minimum wage, secured workers' pensions, and much more. And his most recent book among a number of bestsellers is Reason. And Dr. Reich, every Labor Day, we always sort of lament at the state of labor, given the inexorable statistics that indicate that fewer and fewer American workers, for example, are in unions. What is your brief reading of the temperature of the health of American labor?
Well, Ian, in terms of labor unions, it is not nearly as healthy, obviously, as unions were 30 years ago. In 1955, over a third of American workers belonged to unions. Now, in the private sector, the percentage is fewer than 8% belong to unions. But, of course, the effects of organized labor and union workers extended far beyond and have extended far beyond the number of workers who are in unions. In the 1950s, 1960s, even by the 1970s, prevailing hourly wages in most industries reflected what the union contracts were in those industries, even for workers who were not in unions. So that those contracts tended in the 50s and 60s and 70s to mean that most workers rose as productivity increased in the economy. As the economy overall did better, most workers, unionized and non-unionized, also did better. But of course, in the last 30 years, as unions have declined, as the number of unionized workers has dropped and unions have less power, those contracts are less meaningful. They don't spread beyond the particular company or the particular unionized workers. Most workers in this country are not unionized, and they have seen their hourly wages stagnate. If they're male workers, on an hourly basis, their hourly wages are actually lower in terms of real purchasing power than they were in the 1970s.
Well, I think it's widely recognized that some of the best paid union jobs are in the auto working sphere. And it's since we don't have labor parties like the Western Europeans do that are directly connected to unions and therefore go into politics with a much more focus in that regard, whereas the Democratic Party is obviously a much bigger tent. Given that what's happening with the UAW, apparently, with their concessions that they're having to make, and with the auto sector in general, that apparently one of the reasons why they're opening plants in Canada is more to do with the healthcare costs. So I guess it sort of takes us back to the political questions is surely we need better political representation. I mean, you were in an administration that started out with Hillary Clinton trying to reform healthcare, and look where we are today. We're losing jobs because of this dysfunctional healthcare system.
Yeah. Well, the healthcare system certainly is dysfunctional. In the 1940s, 1950s, union leaders agreed with the leaders of big business to make healthcare and pensions part of most union contracts. There were some tax advantages to doing so because the health benefits in union contracts were not taxed as income. And the pension benefits, those taxes would be deferred until those pensions paid off. So it made sense at the time, and because so many Americans were in unions and companies were so big, as Engine Charlie Wilson said when Eisenhower appointed him Secretary of Defense, I can't see the difference between General Motors, where I used to be chief executive, and the interests of the country. They're one and the same. We're so big, I can't imagine that we would have anything different. But undoubtedly, with the demise of unions, we've seen also much more intense competition among companies. General Motors cannot afford the huge healthcare costs per automobile, more than it's paying for steel in each automobile. And it pits companies that are providing healthcare against companies that are not providing health insurance. Same thing with pensions. And I think inevitably leads to the conclusion that we've got to decouple health insurance and pensions from employment. Now, you raise the question, who's going to do it? Bill Clinton tried with health care in 1994 and failed, and that was even with a Democratic Congress, you remember.
Mm-hmm.
How could we ever do that again? Well, we're going to do it, and I'm sure we're going to do it, because most Americans, unionized or non-unionized, are finding that they can't afford health insurance because their employers are pushing more and more of the premium costs and the co-payments and the deductibles onto their workers. So middle-class workers across America are crying foul. We just can't afford it. There will be, I'm absolutely certain of it, in the next administration, whether it's Republican or Democratic, there will be an attempt once again to revive the drive toward universal, affordable national health care.
Let's talk about then the means by which there will be implementation of these changes, and that clearly would be the begin in the November elections. And in the American Prospect, Dr. Reich, you wrote recently that you sort of castigated the Democrats there's a lot of talk out now about impeachment, a ridiculously preemptive notion, given that the objective of impeachment, is to put on a trial. So you've got to gather the evidence for first. So before you talk about impeaching President Bush, it would be worthwhile trying to win the House at least. So therefore, you'd have subpoena power and then gather the evidence. So there is that sort of impetuous and immature talk on the Democratic side, as well as threats of paying them back for the capricious way that they hounded every member of Bill Clinton's cabinet and effectively used special prosecution as a means to diminish President Clinton's ability to govern. It was clearly a tactic. So you're arguing against that kind of payback. Give us a sense of your argument.
Well, it's not that, there's certainly a lot of frustration among Democrats, and if you happen to live along the West Coast or along the East Coast or some places in between, you are sure, as I happen to be, that this is the worst president we've ever had in the history of our republic. And many Democrats, looking at the Iraqi war and the failures there, the economy and the widening gap between rich and poor, the blunders of the Katrina, we could go on. It's a long list. And they say, well, if we get the House back in November and take the House over in January, then let's just give them hell. Let's hold hearings and rake them over the coals, these Republicans, this Bush administration. The problem to me is, number one, most America knows the failures, and to rehearse them, it will just seem even more partisan. In fact, it may even cast the failures in a slightly less credible light, because a lot of Americans will say, well, maybe it was partisan all along. It wasn't quite as much of a failure as we thought. Secondly, it's not as if a Democratic House of Representatives is going to be able to subpoena this administration and get more information. The administration will absolutely be as tightly shut as it has been in the past. Democrats are going to spend years in the federal courts trying to get information that they will ultimately never get. But thirdly, and I think most importantly, that strategy assumes that George W. Bush is vulnerable somehow, and he's not running again. The next presidential candidate will probably be, from the Republican side, John McCain, who has distinguished himself in part by positioning himself apart from the Bush administration, very different from the Bush administration. So Democrats run the risk of just sounding like they're negative Eeyores without new ideas for where to take the nation. So my recommendation, very strongly, if the Democrats do take over the House this fall and officially take over next January, as I think is increasingly likely, the Democrats use the opportunity to lay out a positive agenda for the future. What is the Democrat idea for health care? Not in a policy wonk detail, but just what's actually going to happen? Are we going to roll back taxes, the tax cuts, to what they were in the Clinton years? Is that going to be able to afford us safe and affordable and universal health care? Are we going to do something about global warming? And if so, are we going to try to find, I say we because I'm a Democrat, the industries of the future that are non-carbon based? How do we do that? How do we really reduce our dependence on oil? How do we deal with this persistent problem of poverty that seems to be growing? In fact, it's grown every year during this recovery. I think in year four, we just learned we have the highest poverty rate. It didn't get any higher, but it's still higher than any fourth year of any recovery in history. And what do we do about all of this? I think Democrats should use the opportunity to lay out a cogent plan for the future. Get Americans dreaming again about what's possible in this country.
One of your colleagues up there at Berkeley, George Lakoff, has talked about how the Democrats are on the defensive in terms of semantics, how arguments are framed, and you know the death tax being a perfect example of the way the Republicans have framed a giveaway to the rich. But the thing that I don't understand, the point that Democrats haven't made, is that all of Bush's tax cuts are phonies, and the very people who think they're being benefited aren't, because these are not tax cuts. These are tax deferments. The tax will eventually have to be paid because the deficit is just digging a huge hole in the Treasury. So, and there's also an expectation amongst a number of economists that there'll be a very nasty recession in 07, which would then dry up a lot of the revenues. So, the landscape's not looking particularly good, and it seems like President Bush is going to sort of wreck the economy, and of course we know he's wrecked foreign policy, and just sort of waltz off into retirement and leaving whoever else holding the bag.
Well, Ian, it goes far beyond rhetoric. I think George Lakoff is correct that Democrats have not used the right language, but we're not talking here only about language by any means. As you suggested, these are policy mistakes fundamental errors of judgment that are getting the country into deeper and deeper trouble for, I hope not, but I expect and fear for generations. With regard to supply-side economics, those tax cuts in 2001-2003, not only have they shot a hole in the deficit, but you're right, they have to be paid back, but it's occurring exactly at the wrong time. It's when baby boomers are moving toward their retirements. They're going to need Social Security and Medicare that we cannot, as a nation, now afford, given the fact that the surpluses in those trust funds, those Social Security and Medicare surpluses, are being used to disguise the extent of the budget deficit. This is something we don't talk about in this country. Democrats should be screaming this from the roofs. It's not a matter of using necessarily just the right words. It's a matter of focusing the public's attention on what really is going on.
Well, on the foreign policy sphere, and again, another question as to why where the Democrats have put on the defensive unnecessarily. Given that the Iraq is probably one of the great blunders in history, and it is an optional war that a war that didn't have to be fought, and it is again a huge sucking wound where we've already obviously lost the war long ago, but for some reason or other, President Bush's blunder has become the Democrats' problem. How did they get snookered like that?
Well, Democrats, I don't understand why more Democrats who voted for the Iraqi war resolution have not come forward and said simply, look, we were mistaken, we were misled, the data we saw from the administration was wrong. The administration said we needed to vote with them to get something through the UN, and then the administration turned their back on the United Nations. I mean, Democrats need to be able to say very clearly to the public, this was a mistake right from the beginning. And we Democrats, yes, we are going to inherit this mistake. The whole country is going to inherit this mistake. It's not a partisan problem. It's a problem for all of us and our children as well. As soon as we possibly can, we've got to maybe partition Iraq into Sunni and Shiite and Kurdish regions under international auspices, get out, focus our attention on terrorism, make the nation safer, create a climate in the world in which more nations are willing to work with us instead of regard us as the world's bully. But you see, I think Democrats need to right away, and especially if they have the megaphone that comes with running the House of Representatives, be able to say to the country, we have a fundamentally different approach to terrorism and to foreign policy. It's not simply a matter of how quickly we withdraw our troops, what the timetable is going to be. We have a different worldview that is much more in keeping with where the world is, what the world needs, what our national security interests really are.
Just finally then, Dr. Robert Reich, recently we had Senator Byron Dorgan on the program, who has written a book, Take This Job and Ship It, and he was railing against outsourcing and downsizing. And you've also written about how Dow Chemical is building a research center in Shanghai, and IBM has opened a software lab in Bangalore, and Microsoft has invested $1.7 billion in India, will be investing it in developing a center in Hyderabad. So if in the information age, all that we've got since our manufacturing sector has been hollowed out, all we've got is our intellectual property and our inventiveness. It seems that the minute you ship that the intellectual property to abroad, it gets counterfeited. So I don't see how, with pharma and software and the advantages that we have, which are generated by intellectual property, how are we going to maintain this edge if we're shipping our brains or buying brains abroad?
Well, Ian, in that question you just gave me, I counted five pronouns. We and our, particularly the possessive pronouns. Well, I'll tell you, there's a lot of confusion when you come to globalization about who's us and who's them. Global companies headquartered in the United States are not necessarily us. and what they do in terms of creating research centers and sharing intellectual property abroad and creating manufacturing centers abroad, that may be good for the companies, even though they're headquartered in Delaware or in New York or in California, but they're not necessarily good for us as American citizens and as American workers who need to be well-educated, who need to understand the technology, who need to be innovative in the world, who need to develop and maintain our share of the high-value-added industries of the world. And that's why we're in a terrible bind, because we assume, and this administration has led us to assume, that the interests of this economy are coterminous or exactly identical with the interests of large American corporations. Well, they aren't. We need to invest substantially in healthcare and in education, in job training, in early childhood education, in access of anybody who needs it to post-secondary education. Why? Not because our businesses need those workers. Our businesses can go anywhere around the world for the talent they need. No, because we need it. We need it to maintain our standard of living in the future.
Well, I guess we're going to have to start demanding some kind of social contract here. And,
there used to be a social contract in which we understood business, labor, government, we as individual citizens understood that we were not just participants single-handedly in an economy, but we were citizens in a society who, as citizens, owed one another things and were interdependent as citizens. We're losing that. And that, it seems to me, is the most important message the Democrats can deliver if they're capable of delivering it. And that is, we're all in this together. There is a common good. And as citizens, we owe each other a great deal.
And, of course, we fought a bloody civil war against slavery, and here we are seemingly accepting it, cohabitating with it. I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles, Dr. Robert Reich.
Thank you, Ian. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Hello again. I'm Ian Masters, just speaking with Dr. Robert Reich, who served for three national administrations, most recently as the nation's 22nd Secretary of Labor under President Bill Clinton. He's also the author of Reason. I'm now speaking with Dr. Vali Nasser, who's a professor in the Department of National Security Affairs at the Naval Postgraduate School. He's the author of a number of books, including Democracy in Iran, The Islamic Leviathan, Islam and the Making of State Power, and the most recent, The Shia Revival, How Conflicts Within Islam Will Shape the Future. And a couple of weeks ago, Dr. Nasser and a small group of outside advisors met with President Bush to bring a fresh perspective on the Iranian question. Of course, the Iranian question is now front and center as the United Nations Security Council is poised to decide whether or not to issue sanctions against Iran for their nuclear enrichment program, which they appear not to want to shut down. However, today, I believe in Tehran, Kofi Annan has gotten some indication that the Iranians may be willing to talk. Dr. Nasser, what can you tell us about that?
Well, good morning.
Good morning.
The Iranian position has all along been to say no to suspension of enrichment as a precondition for talks, and the way in which the United Nations demanded that they do it, but have always left the door open for more talks. They did this when they responded to the United Nations proposal, and again, I think they've taken the occasion of Kofi Annan's visit to underscore the fact that they would like to talk, but they would not want the suspension of uranium enrichment to be a precondition for talks.
Well, we never talk about the discussion in the press about uranium enrichment, and Iran going nuclear. It's basically become America and Israel's problem. But there are domestic politics in Iran, and I'm curious as to why this leader, who started out, ran as an economic populist against a very wealthy mullah, Rafsanjani, whose wealth is questionable, I should suggest, and now suddenly he's discovered this issue. So let's talk for a moment about what the Iranian politics are, not the Israeli or the American politics. What are the Iranian politics of this nuclear issue?
Well, first of all, we have to note that unlike many other countries in Iran, the president is not the ultimate decision maker. He's the head of the executive branch of the Iranian government, but he's not the head of state. The head of state in Iran is the supreme leader of Iran, who has been in that position since 1989, and he ultimately makes the decision regarding the direction of Iran's nuclear power. What the current president is doing is that over the past year, he has established the more hardline expression of what Iran wants. And in this sense, he is appealing to nationalist sentiment within Iran that sees the right to acquiring nuclear technology and not the bomb as an inherent Iranian right, as in a manifestation of Iran's claim to being a regional power. And they depict the insistence of the United States, Israel, or the United Nations for Iran to suspend enrichment to be a demand to keep Iran in the dark ages, to deny it technological development. Now, this is the way in which this debate has been put in the public sphere in Iran, and as a result, Ahmadinejad very cleverly manipulates this sense of aggrievement, this sense of Iran not being recognized, this new status, to his own advantage. So when the president of the United States did not respond to his letter, or the offer of a debate was turned down, he turned to the population and said, well, you know, they don't want to talk. They really don't want a resolution. What they want is to keep us backwards.
And that plays well, I believe, beyond Iran in what's called the Arab Street.
It plays well in the Arab Street, but not with the Arab governments. And the nuclear issue is not as effective on the Arab Street as Iran's attacks on Israel, the Holocaust, or support for the Palestinian cause. That plays very well in the Arab Street.
But the notion that he went the extra mile and wrote a letter, which they didn't even bother to reply to, and then more recently offered to debate, that goes down well, I believe.
It does. It's not just the offer of the letter. It's the tone. Because Ahmadinejad's tone, which was counterproductive in the sense that it did not really encourage the administration in the United States to take his offer of response, but it had a kind of an overconfident tone to it that plays very well in the Arab Street, which is frustrated with its own leadership's inability to have any influence in Washington and is seen to be weak and unable to assert itself.
And meanwhile, of course, Ahmadinejad is cracking down on dissent. He's just arresting a bunch of students who've been held going back to 1999. He's about to shut down the Iranian Nobel laureate. So I'd like to get a sense from you, Dr. Vali Nasser, about his apocalyptic tendencies, if you will. Bob Baird, the CIA officer, who told me that he thinks that Ahmadinejad is quite apocalyptic, and that the bombing of the Samarra Mosque really set him off, and that his belief in the 12th Imam, with whom he apparently communicates by dropping notes down wells, is a sort of messianic figure. So can you tell us the significance of the 12th Imam in and of course I think the Al-Mahdi army is also an instrument of the 12th Imam in a sense. So my understanding, a cursory understanding that it is, seems to indicate that there are connections between this Shia fundamentalism and the kind of Christian fundamentalism that's associated with the Book of Revelation and the Rapture and the core group, incidentally,
who
support President Bush in this country.
Absolutely. I mean, Shiites have a messianic doctrine, much like Jews have or Christians have. And in fact, Shiites believe that when the hidden Imam comes back, he will bring a period of justice before the second coming of Christ. And therefore, in some ways, the Shiites believe in the second coming of Christ as well. Now, like both Christianity and Judaism, there are those who believe in the Messiah, but they don't really expect it anytime soon. And there are those who have much more of a deep emotional and religious attachment to the coming of the Messiah, which in the United States in recent years has been very popular among evangelical groups with the expectation of the rapture. But that does not mean that Ahmadinejad personally is actually looking to finish off the world on his own. In many ways, I think he's manipulating what is a popular belief in the Messiah and popular love for the Messiah. So when he sends notes down that well, essentially he's trying to appeal to the kind of sentiments that are on the street in a devotional way attached to the Messiah. I don't know his personal beliefs. I don't think anybody does. And all Shiites believe in the Messiah. There's not going to be any Shia, any practicing Shia who's going to say that they don't believe in the Messiah. But to read into this that in some ways his main mission is to bring about Armageddon is a mistake. I think as a politician, he's very cleverly manipulating the sentiments on the streets, religious sentiments on the street, the same way as he has manipulated economic frustrations on the street to his own advantage.
Well, I would like to get a sense, Dr. Vallianasser, of the connections to what's going on in Iraq, given that it's widely understood that Iran has become been essentially rewarded by the U.S.'s blunder in Iraq. And I know when you met with the president, it was the time of these tremendous demonstrations where up to a million Shia demonstrated in support of Hezbollah, and apparently the president was concerned and sort of blindsided by that. What is the role of the Al-Mahdi Army and Muqtada al-Sadr? It seems to me that in many ways that's an option that the Iranians have in their pocket, because so far that's the civil war has been essentially Shiite and Sunni fighting each other, but there's no incentive on the parts of the Shiite to go after the United States, but for that short battle that they had a couple of years back, simply because the United States is doing the Shiites' dirty work by killing the Sunni insurgents. So I get the impression that the other shoe hasn't dropped, and I'm wondering whether that is something that Ahmadinejad has some influence over, and whether or not if we were to do something foolish like a military action against Iran, that would be easy to unleash Muqtada al-Sadr. That would take essentially a phone call.
Iranians' relationships with Muqtada al-Sadr has been growing 2003 in a very steady manner, even though Muqtada has always, at the beginning, was very anti-Iranian, and in a chauvinistic way, he was very anti-Iranian. And he attacked Ayatollah Sistani on the charge of his being of Iranian origin, and that he stood for Iraqi nationalism. Nevertheless, in practice, his movement has become much closer to Iran. And also because partly the Mahdi Army is not a unified military force. It has many different sub-militias within it, which are loyal to different local rulers, who then in turn are loyal to Muqtada al-Sadr. But the problem in Iraq, in my opinion, is that we began to lose the Shia when about a year ago we began to change strategy. At the beginning, we were doing the Shia's dirty work, the way you put it, of fighting the Sunnis. But somewhere along the line in late 2005, we really decided, well, we don't have to pay much attention to the Shiites. They have no choice but to follow along with us. And we should now focus on bringing the Sunnis into the political process. And this happened right before the bombing of the Samarra shrine. And I think it began to create a distance between us and the Shiites. They began to be distrustful of the United States. The moderate Shiites who were working with the U.S. began to lose faith. And this benefited the anti-American voices among the Shiites like Muqtada al-Sadr. Now, the other problem that the U.S. has in the region is that we're trying to work with the Shias in Iraq, who are our allies in this government, and the prime minister and much of the cabinet are moderate Shiites. But we are essentially supported a war against the Shiites in Lebanon, and we are at loggerheads with the Shia government in Iran. So in other words, there is certain, if you would, tensions with our policy in the region. And Muqtada al-Sadr feels far closer, if you would, to the Hezbollah model and far closer to Iran. His stock in Iraq has been on the rise because his militia is on the ground fighting, if you would, to protect and perpetuate the interests of his community. And at the same time, his family had deep roots with Lebanon. He has deep ties with Iran. So, yes, we could see the other shoe drop if something, again, a major crisis happens in the region, like a confrontation with Iran or a second confrontation in Lebanon, or if we take the Mahdi army on in a head-on fashion and are not able to control the consequences, you could then really push the Shiites in Iraq away from the current coalition with the U.S. administration and confirm Muqtada's leadership.
And if that were to take place, then the civil war, which many argue whether or not it's happening, but it seems with 3,500 a month being civilians being killed, it's hard not to describe it as it is. I can't see how a broader civil war would not become a regional war, and in effect, you could argue that it's already a surrogate war with Iran supporting and supplying the Shia and Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Egypt, and the Gulf supporting and supplying the Sunni, who are at this point essentially being ethnically cleansed out of Baghdad and driven into Al-Anbar province.
Well, and vice versa. We often also forget that the Sunnis really began this civil war, and for 2 years they were attacking Shiites and provoking them. The Shiites really only joined the battle since the destruction of the shrine in February of 2006. And our inability to protect the Shiites, and at the same time signaling to them that we were willing to make a deal with the insurgents, possibly at their cost, really convinced them that they could not rely on the U.S. to do the dirty work, and they had to rely on their own militias. But I think you point to a more important issue, and that is that when, for instance, we dealt with the fall of the Taliban in Afghanistan, before we tried to create a government and a constitution and elections, we had all the regional powers to get together in Germany in a conference in Bonn. So before we went about regime change in Afghanistan, we already got the buy-in of everybody in the neighborhood about how their interests would be represented and protected in new Afghanistan. So they had a vested interest. In Iraq, we didn't work with any of the neighbors, whether they were friendly or enemies, whether it was Syria, Iran, or Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, or Jordan. So each of these countries, because they're not part of a framework of a new order in Iraq, each of them is following their own interests on their own independently. And as a result, if and when things begin to get nasty, and if the United States pulls out, each of them is going to try to get in order to protect their interests. So Iranians will support the Shiites in the south and some of the Turkmen groups and the likes in the north. And the Sunni governments will support the Sunnis. And what we don't know is that what will happen with the Kurds in the north between Iran, Syria, and Turkey. But there is no doubt, because there is no consensus in the countries around them as to what their stake, what their interest is in Iraq or in the future of Iraq. Each of them is looking after their own interests.
Well, of course, at this point, the Turks are threatening to move into Kurdistan because of the PKK. So that's an extra spanner in the works, if you will. But under any kind of regional war condition, it's hard not to imagine that the Straits of Hormuz would be closed. And, of course, suddenly Russia would be the world's biggest oil supplier. But just in closing, Dr. Vali Nasser, back to Ahmadinejad's meeting, as we mentioned in the beginning, with Kofi Annan in Tehran as we speak, and it looks like the Iranian government is now willing to put everything on the table. I just keep hearing these rumors, and Cy Hirsch in The New Yorker keeps writing about this, that President Bush does not want to leave office without having stopped this program, either through negotiations or through military action. And it seems that when Ahmadinejad uses descriptions about driving Israel into the sea and exterminating Jews, that is the most incendiary language imaginable, and he's really playing with fire there. And at the end of the day, it may be an Israeli nuclear weapon that gets rid of Iran's nuclear program. So do you believe that the Iranian government recognizes that they're playing with fire?
I think they are gradually learning that they are playing with fire. But you see, it goes back to the same issue I mentioned at the beginning, namely Ahmadinejad is not the entire Iranian government. He's a faction in there. And Ahmadinejad is trying to consolidate his own position, and he sees benefit in this kind of incendiary attacks on Israel, regardless of what it does for Iran's international position. There is no doubt that Ahmadinejad is not doing Iran any favors in terms of putting forward the image of a responsible nuclear technology power in the region. But the problematic is not is how do you deal with it. I think, first of all, reducing Iran to Ahmadinejad can be counterproductive. It only strengthens his hand. Secondly, there is no, in my opinion, there is no easy military option, because Iran's nuclear capability is not in one location like Iraq's in Iraq. It is spread over 70 sites or so that we only know about, and none of these can be easily taken out by an air war. As we saw, air war in Lebanon was rather limited in its usefulness. It could devastate the country, but could not take out all of Hezbollah's long-range and medium-range missile capability, which kept coming all the way till the last day of the war. So short of something like a land invasion occupation of Iran, which only the United States could do, and even there it has a great deal of limitations because of its resources being bogged down in Iraq, I don't think there is an easy military response to Iran. If the U.S. were to hit Iran but not able to get results that it wants, then, you know, it has to contend with a regime that now feels justified in developing nuclear weapon. It may be pushed back a few years, but then it's going to be doubly vigilant in developing weapons and may actually cause a lot more trouble elsewhere. In other words, the West and the United States, in my opinion, have the capability to start a war, but they don't have a capability of finishing it easily. And that is where the dilemma is how you deal with a militant government where it doesn't feel that we have the capability to stop it. We have to think of what levers we have in order to influence its behavior within the context that we find ourselves in.
Well, just on that note, Vali Nasser, the levers, I would think the intelligent way to proceed would be, if possible, to separate the Iranian people. The young and the women apparently are very restive at any rate. And there was moments under Khatami's government where you got the impression that the reform movement was the majority movement. So why not separate this government from the people rather than through threats drive the people into the arms of the government? After all, nobody in Iran wants to be liberated by the United States if Iraq is the model.
Well, that's been the case. Nor do the Iranians want to be bombed if Lebanon is what might rest in the future. Generally, wars never favor democracy. Generally, wars and situations of national security don't favor civil liberties. They always give authoritarian governments the ability to get the people to rally to the flag and put aside all other debates while this is happening. We're even seeing this in the Arab world, that the talk of democracy is dying down when you have heightened tensions in the region. I think in some ways isolating Iran and threatening it is only going to strengthen the hands of this government, which is able then to focus attention domestically on nationalistic issues, whereas I think we need to find ways to force this government to open up and provide greater space to those forces that we would like to become empowered in Iran. And I think in some ways, relinquishing Iran to Ahmadinejad will condemn the democratic forces that we want to support to marginality.
I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles, Dr. Vali Nasser.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking then with Dr. Vali Nasser, professor in the Department of National Security Affairs at the Naval Postgraduate School. And a couple of weeks ago, Dr. Nasser and a small group of outside advisors met with President Bush to bring a fresh perspective on the Iranian question. I'm now speaking with Tom Hartman, who's a nationally syndicated radio host with Air America and a Project Censored award-winning best-selling author of 17 books. His books include The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, We the People, Unequal Protection, What Would Jefferson Do, and his most recent book, Screwed, The Undeclared War Against the Middle Class, and What We Can Do About It. And Tom Hartman, it seems that, I don't know whether you've ever seen that classic movie, The Best Years of Our Lives, but it was in 1948 at the end of World War II, there was a sense that there was a social contract in this country, and the GI Bill excuse me, and the Levittown and all of that stuff created this idea that this is a middle-class country. And, of course, the middle class are increasingly becoming endangered species. And but for their home equity, they would be all in the working class. And, of course, we know that the home equity bubble may, in fact, be about to burst. So what's going on here vis-a-vis the wrecking crew in the White House? Is it possible that George W. Bush is like Ronald Reagan, who in many ways was a medievalist? George W. Bush seems to have a kind of plantation mentality where he and his rich cronies are sitting on the veranda of the antebellum mansion drinking mint juleps served by a black waiter, and the rest of us are toiling in the lower 40.
That's a great metaphor, Ian. By the way, thank you for having me on your program. It's an honor and a pleasure to be here. Yes. What we are seeing right now is a complete flip, virtually an upside-down flip of the view that America had of itself over the last 70 years. You could go back to the 1860s, 1870s, 1880s, the post-Civil War era Reconstruction. And, you know, there was a sense of a middle class and the importance of a middle class. It produced or birthed the populist movement, the progressive movement. The robber barons took over in the 1880s, 1890s, you know, ruled until the Republican Great Depression, but ruled against a lot of popular resistance. And then in the 30s, Franklin Roosevelt came out and said essentially the same thing Thomas Jefferson said, which is without an educated and economically viable middle class, you can't have democracy. And so recognizing that laissez-faire capitalism will never produce a middle class, it never has in 7,000 years of its history. Instead, what it produces is a small ruling class or small economic ruling class, wealthy elite, and a large class of the working poor. Roosevelt set out to rewrite the rules of business, the laws of business, to strengthen labor unions and strengthen pensions and essentially say, if you're going to play the game of business, you're going to do it in a way that's going to produce a middle class because that's the best thing for America and for democracy. In 1980, Reagan came into office and declared war on the American middle class and on the American working people. The first shot across the bow was the PATCO, his busting the PATCO strike, the anniversary of which was just a month or so ago. And we've seen it go downhill ever since. In the meantime, there has been the other thing that happened in the 80s was that the Republicans declared war on the teaching of civics in our schools, you know, with this whole thing of, oh, there's these socialist teachers, they're all members of unions, they're teaching, they call it civics, but they're teaching communism. And now, for all practical purposes, we have kids graduating from high school who have virtually no idea of the history of America. They don't know who the Wobblies were. They don't know the history of the labor movement. They know a few, you know, dates, and that's about it. That has worked tremendously to the benefit of the conservatives.
But it seems that, Tom Hartman, that's ultimately our challenge as American citizens. It seems that we have a choice either to be passive consumers or active citizens.
Yes.
And the Rupert Murdochs of this world clearly want us to be passive consumers and vote on American Idol, but not necessarily vote in the elections. And I guess the question, and I think this goes to what you just said, is that the way to reverse that is to instill civics and to in effect unleash what the Founding Fathers bequeathed to the American people, which is the incredible value of citizenship.
Yes, and from the founders through the, frankly, even through the Republican Eisenhower, you know, there was this sense of the American middle class and the importance of it. And it's really interesting. What we're seeing now is the confluence of two groups who, in the past, have never really aligned themselves. You have the financial conservatives, for lack of a better word, basically the financial elite, the ruling financial elite, who basically are motivated by greed. You know, let's get more. And then combined with that, you've got the people who, in the 1960s and 1970s, the peak of the American middle class, when the American middle class was at its strongest, when college students could get into pretty much any college. It was virtually free. I mean, my wife worked her way through college as a waitress in a Howard Johnson's. I worked my way through college working in radio. Which was back then a minimum wage job. You could do that. Okay. And That was also the time when women were saying, hey, wait a minute, we want equal rights, and African Americans were saying, hey, wait a minute, we want equal rights, and people were, you know, people were in the streets. And so the social conservatives, for lack of a better word, because it's not just about abortion and gay rights and things, the social conservatives looked at this and said, oh my God, this is American society melting down, just like Russell Kirk predicted in 1953, or you know, Sir Edmund Burke predicted in 1790. And we have to put a stop to this. What's causing this? Well, what's causing this is there's all these middle-class people who have too much time on their hands. And, you know, they're getting uppity. And so, you know, the idea of, you know, a strong middle class with time for vacation and all your medical expenses are covered, and if you lose this job, there's always another good job, good manufacturing job. All that stuff had to be swept away in order to prepare the ground for the rise of a conservative ruling elite. And they've done a very good job of it.
Well, but this particular conservative ruling elite now is starting to question people's patriotism and use analogies with appeasing Hitler in World War II. And it seems to me that the tables could be very easily turned on these plutocrats and their Christian soldiers in to the extent to which you can argue that the new American capitalists are not patriots. They have their tax havens in the Cayman Islands. They outsource their jobs. And we were just talking earlier with the former Secretary of Labor, Robert Rush, about how even the so-called benign companies like Microsoft are investing billions in Hyderabad in India, and Dow Chemical has just opened a research center in Beijing.
Yeah, I was in India back, I don't know, maybe 8 or 10 years ago when Microsoft first came in and was having a hiring fair. They were going to hire 50,000 people, top salary, $10,000 a year, and they had all these people with master's degrees from all over India coming down south. Yes, absolutely. And that's
brains on the cheap, eh?
Yeah, and that's why, you know, I'm doing the radio show I'm doing, you're doing the one you're doing, I'm writing the books I'm writing. We have to get the word out. And frankly, I think that most Americans at a visceral level know this. They just don't have enough of the detail to be able to say, oh, here's the mechanism, here's how they're doing it. And when they get that, then they become politically empowered and they can move forward. The problem is that they're not going to get any of that from the mainstream media, which is now controlled by the same corporate wealth/wealth elite that is in favor of there not being a middle class.
They're the people that are screwing us, use a play on your title of your book, Screwed, The Undeclared War Against the Middle Class.
Well said, Ian.
So give us a sense then of the marching orders that are in your book.
Well, I suggest that we need to take back the institutions of power in the United States. When Franklin Roosevelt in 1936 said, you know, it was human nature and perhaps natural that this new economic ruling class would rise up to seize control of government itself. And then he went on to say, as a result of this, the average man is now faced with the same challenge as the Minuteman. He says, these people complain that we are trying to destroy the institutions of America. What in fact they're complaining about is that we seek to take away their power. And then, and this was in his July 1936 speech where he accepted his second nomination as president, he said, and our allegiance to American democracy requires the overthrow of this kind of power. And he did, to a large extent. And we need to do it again. And basically because the United States is one of only a small handful, a half a dozen democracies in the world that don't have proportional representation. You know, we have this two-party system that we inherited from the founders, who really, you know, is the best they could do. John Stuart Mill didn't develop proportional representation until 1860, you know. So really what we have to do is what the conservatives decided to do back in the late 1960s after the defeat of Barry Goldwater, and that's take over one of the two major political parties. And so I suggest, you know, let's take over the Democratic Party, let's rise it to prominence, and let's take it back to its roots, its Franklin Roosevelt roots, and frankly, the roots of its founder, Thomas Jefferson.
Well, here we have Vice President Cheney and Rumsfeld and now the President suggesting again, you know, one of the ways that the Republicans became the majority party, particularly in terms of national security in the period of McCarthy, was to hoist this canard that if you were progressive on domestic politics, you were therefore aiding and abetting a foreign enemy, the Soviet Union. And now they're revisiting that notion with so-called Islamofascism.
Right.
But you have also talked about Vice President Wallace, FDR's vice president, who wrote in the New York Times in April the 9th of 1944 about American fascism. I'll just quote, the really dangerous American fascists, Wallace wrote, are not those who are hooked up directly or indirectly with the Axis. The FBI has its finger on those. The dangerous American fascist is the man who wants to do in the United States in an American way that wants to do in the United States in an American way what Hitler did in Germany in a Prussian way. The American fascist would prefer not to use violence. His method is to poison the channels of public information. With a fascist, the problem is never how best to present the truth to the public, but how best to use the news to deceive the public into giving the fascist and his group more money and more power. And I must say that, you know, every time I look at Fox News, I'm reminded of Pravda, and I just find it disgraceful that in a free country, a news organization would willingly become the Ministry of Information for a sitting government, a government, whether it's Democratic or Republican. So I see a real slippery slope here.
Oh, indeed, and in large part, you can trace it right back to 1987 when Ronald Reagan did away with the Fairness Doctrine. It wasn't just the Fairness Doctrine he did away with. He did away with the premise that in order for a radio or television station to maintain its operating license, it must serve the public good. And the way back in those days that was defined was by producing real news, which is why all the networks had news divisions that were separate from entertainment, separate from advertising, and most of them actually operated at a loss. But it was the necessary cost to keep a license. And Reagan did away with that, and then Bill Clinton put the total nail in the coffin in 1996 when he signed the Telecommunications Act. And now we don't have news in the United States anymore, outside of, I would argue, programs like yours and public radio, perhaps. But by and large, what we have instead is infotainment. And infotainment is all about making a profit, which has nothing to do with democracy. Capitalism is an economic system. Democracy is a political system. And, you know, democracy can operate without capitalism. Capitalism, frankly, has a challenge operating in the presence of democracy.
Well, just in closing, Tom Hutton, we're running out of time here. I believe you're coming to Los Angeles, so people might want to check you out and hear what you have to say.
I'll be on September 30th. I'll be doing a little speech and book signings at Roman's Bookstore in Pasadena and at the Bodhi Tree in Hollywood. Should be a lot of fun.
Well, I look forward to it. And thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much, Ian.
Bye-bye.
Keep up the great work.
Thank you. Bye-bye. And I have just been speaking with Tom Hutton. He's a nationally syndicated radio host with Air America Radio and Project Censored, award-winning, best-selling author of 17 books. His latest, Screw the Undeclared War Against the Middle Class and What We Can Do About It. I want to thank Louis Vandenberg, the producer, Rusty Wynn, the associate producer, Carol Coote, the assistant producer, Jazz Shepherd, the engineer.